Well, hello everybody out there in podcast land, and welcome to a very special episode of the Front Row Network's Full Disclosure. Tonight we have a very special episode lined up. We are going to talk about two films that were given to us a very unique way. But before we dive into that and the circumstances surrounding that, I have to introduce my host. First, I am Ryan Lutens, host of Front Row Flashbacks, and with me tonight is
Jay Hoffman
and Steve Sykes.
Two awesome collaborators for the Front Row Networks. Thank you for joining me, guys. Steve, this was your idea. Thanks for coming up with this. Tonight, we are going to talk about two movies that were released digitally because of COVID-19. We live in a very strange world out there where our movie theaters are shut down. And we are going to talk tonight about two movies that were released right before this pandemic hit and weren't really given a chance to thrive. One actually did. We'll get to that later. One was actually released a week before everything broke out and didn't really perform too well. And actually, a lot of people have cited that this is a reason why it didn't make a whole lot of money. But I think that that is going to change once it's hit the circuit, which both of these movies have been released digitally for the past month. And we are going to take this time to discuss them. We are talking about the movies The Hunt and The Invisible Man. Both of these movies are considered horror genre. One's more like a horror comedy. One's another thriller, but they both deal in the realm of horror. The way Full Disclosures work out is we are going to talk about every nook and cranny of these two films, but we are going to ease into them. So if you are listening and have not seen these movies, we will let you know when to turn away. First up, we are actually going to talk about The Hunt. The Hunt is a movie that is in the realm of The Purge and things along those lines. If you go to IMDb, their classification or their little plot synopsis is 12 strangers wake up in a clearing. They don't know where they are or how they got there. They don't know why they've been chosen, but they do know that they have been chosen for a very specific purpose, the hunt. Real quick, let's just talk about any pre-thoughts before we dive deeper. Steve, what were your thoughts about The Hunt before we go into what the movie or how the movie unfolds?
The Hunt tries to work, I think, on several different levels with differing levels of success. As a horror movie, it's spot on. It delivers the delivers the gore, in that respect, it works really well. We'll talk to what degree the satiric element works. Overall, I found it entertaining. And it kind of got better the more that I thought about it. Not an unreserved recommendation, but it was certainly entertaining.
Thanks, Steve. Jay, what were your initial thoughts with The Hunt before we dive deep into it?
I thought it was a lot better than I expected it to be. And I agree with Steve. It was incredibly entertaining. I do think I had a grin on my face most of the movie while it was happening. I agree that the gore and the horror elements were very comedically horror. And like you said, with the satire, maybe some of the stuff was a little too on the nose, which I think is actually something Steve said in one of our discussions. I think he was just dead on. It's just a little too on the nose, but I think it's a bold choice to do that kind of satire nowadays, because I genuinely feel most people don't get satire anymore.
Yeah, I agree with you. Thanks for your thoughts, Jay. This movie actually surprised me. I just thought that this was going to be another, you know, people killing other people for sport. But there's some really good underlying themes that are present in this movie. And the humor in it, too, is actually pretty spot on. So without further ado, if you have not seen The Hunt and you do not want it spoiled for you, you've got 3, 2, 1. Zero. We're about to spoil the crap out of it. This movie has a lot of big name faces, but within the first 5 minutes, they don't have faces. Justin Hartley from This Is Us, Emma Roberts, Ethan Suble, comedian Brian Hartholtz. All these people are big name actors and they are in it for like 5 minutes. Amy Madigan from Field of Dreams, dead. I mean, this movie is just, it's got a great cast. I mean, that's one thing that we can talk about, but before we do that, before we talk about likes and dislikes, this is a movie where people wake up in a field and all of a sudden they just start dying. Previously to that, we see people joking around on text about this hunt that's coming up. We don't know if it's a real hunt or if it's a fake, it's all for laughs, we don't know. But then it actually starts to happen, and that's where the movie gets really, really crazy. Steve, let's dive in. First thoughts about the movie, things that you liked, first off. Go ahead, Steve.
As I recall the opening, I think the opening gave a little bit more away than I would have liked. The first scene on the plane of the hunt's organizers almost seemed to tip a lot off for me. But other than that, it's an interesting way to get going. And the action starts almost immediately, and from there on it's paced really well.
Okay. Jay, what do you think?
I want to reiterate what you said. That beginning sequence where the hunt actually begins, literally the two or three people who I thought were the leads of the movie were dead. And yeah, they're the ones in all the trailers too. So that, I will say that one really caught me off guard. And just like you, I thought this was going to be a pretty straightforward story, but it took us in directions by the end that I really wasn't expecting. And by the time it got to the very end, I was just like, this is not what I thought this movie was about. And so it did surprise me a lot in that way.
Let's just dive right into that, because, you know, this movie is definitely not something that you expect. And the political undertones of this movie are crazy. And I know we're going to dive into that. But you think that you know who these people are and they're just dead. I mean, Emma Roberts gets shot through the head. Justin Hartley from Smallville, Green Arrow, and This Is Us fame steps on a landmine and blows up. He's trying... Again, satire, but he's trying to save somebody. This lady fell on some spikes. She's got a huge spike through her chest. Justin Hartley comes and saves her. We're thinking, yeah, this is going to be our hero. Next thing you know, he steps on a mine and is just blown apart. What's funny, though, is the person that he was saving flies back into the pit of spikes, and she's blown in half but still alive. And then you have Dirk Holtz, a comedian. He's in Neighbors. He comes to save him, and you're like, oh, I know this guy. He's going to be our hero. He goes to the lady in the pit. She wants to commit suicide. She does. And then we follow this guy as he goes to a little mom-and-pop shop gas station. Little do we know that these people are in it. This is Amy Madigan from Field of Dreams fame. She ends up killing this guy. So we're like, who is our lead actress? Then steps in Betty Gillipin from Glow on Netflix. She plays our basically our main hero. Her name is Crystal, and we follow her for the rest of the film. This movie is just crazy in that aspect. But what's really underlying is Steve had mentioned, you know, the opening. You know, we see the setup to this hunt being orchestrated by the super rich. And one of those super rich turns out to be Hilary Swank, a two-time Oscar winner for Boys Don't Cry and Million Dollar Baby. It's funny because I had alluded to how they were jokingly talking about this idea of a hunt. We don't know if the hunt is real or not, or if it's a joke, but it actually becomes reality. And that's where the political satire comes in, because you have the super rich who orchestrate this actual hunt, hunting people, for people who are, you know, not necessarily super rich. I mean, if you look at the names, Emma Roberts' character's name, we don't know her real name except for Yoga Pants. I mean, that could be anybody. I mean, that is a huge alliteration to, you know, the working class. Oh, I'm going to do it in yoga pants. I mean, it's just crazy, because you have the elitist hunting what we're assuming is the middle class. So let's just dive down deep into the central core of this movie, because it is a satire. You know, the super alt right with your guns blazing versus, you know, picking on or hunting the liberal leftist side. Jay, thoughts on that?
I liked where it ended up, especially with the Crystal character. And with her, what I have to say is maybe one of my favorite movie heroines. I thought she was awesome. And
she almost reminded me of Ready or Not, the lead actress in Ready or Not.
Yeah.
There's been a trend in horror movies of kind of subverting the damsel in distress, who becomes like a badass vengeance killer type thing. I was reminded of this, I believe it's French horror movie called High Tension. And that kept coming back to me as I watched Betty Gilpin in this. Definitely a badass, and as it turns out, not as defined by her politics as the rest of the people. As far as that goes, this is where it kind of didn't work for me. The satire is so over the top in both aspects, both satirizing the deplorables, the right wingers, and the liberal elite who are hosting this. They both get the send-up treatment, but it's almost like the writers and director are hedging their bets because, oh, well, the left isn't right and the right's not right. They both sides-ism type thing that kind of makes any point that it was trying to make on that aspect a little blunted for me.
See, that kind of worked for me with the Crystal character. Because what I thought she represented was the overwhelming population who kind of fall somewhere in the middle of both of those political, you know, in the political spectrum, and how unfortunately they kind of get tore apart in these very intense, very ideological arguments that kind of go on in our incredibly political world. And she represented that middle, like, I just want to take care of my family and have a good job and you know, here's what I think, but this, but politics don't run my life. So for me, her character being torn in the middle between those two far ends of the spectrum, I kind of like that.
And I'm going to have to agree with you on that, because for me, it worked in the sense that we later find out that the person who organized this, who is Hillary Swank, she plays Athena, she loses her job over these text messages about the hunt that we see in the very beginning of the movie. So Athena's thinking, you know what? I get fired because of this hunt. I'm going to do it. I'm going to go out and I'm going to kill people. I've got the connections. I'm going to do it. And she does. That's how this whole movie starts off. But you don't know if the hunt has been something that's been going on, or if it's something that Athena just wants to do out of revenge. And if she's going to get busted for it, she's going to do it. So to me, that played really, really well in that aspect of, you know, almost no consequences. I'm rich. I'm going to do what I want, you know, and she's almost butthurt, you know, for lack of a better term. You know, she got fired and for something that, you know, they were just joking around about because they had heard about the hunt. And she's like, you know what? I got fired for this. I'm going to do it. Because later in the film, we find out that the people that they are hunting are all people who had previously alluded to discovering about the hunt. You know, you got, my brain's going a blank. Somebody else wants to run off with this, but each one of the people who were involved as the huntees all slammed the hunt. So
they were all commenters on social media.
Thank
that
you,
propagated Steve. It propagated the conspiracy theory that this actually was happening, that liberals were hunting conservatives. And as you mentioned, it turns out to be not the case. Athena then goes after all of the commenters because she feels that they are responsible for her losing her job. And in this respect, the satire kind of worked for me because it highlights how conspiracy theory culture and how the cancel culture as well, because even something that you're doing jokingly in the privacy of your own home can cost you your livelihood. And I thought that point was pretty well made.
Okay. You know, let's talk about the ending of the film. The ending of the film is probably my favorite part of this whole movie. Crystal ends up tracking down Athena, and Athena wants to be found. And it's just this bare knuckle brawl between these two strong female characters. And I thought it was probably the best ending to a movie, a horror comedy that I've seen in a while. But what are your guys' thoughts on the end? I'll share my thoughts with the after you guys. But what are you guys' thoughts about the end of the film?
I like the ending as well. And mentioning Ready or Not, another similar fantastic ending. I didn't even think of those two movies. Is similar. Now I'm starting to see some of the similarities now that you mentioned it. But no, it was a great ending. Our heroine won, and I think it was the writers and the storytellers trying to say, hey, maybe it's somewhere in the middle of this political world where we're a little more understanding and a little more flexible. And I think that's the point they were trying to get at. But I may be mistaken. But I liked it.
A couple things that struck me about the ending. First of all, the fight between Crystal and Athena. Was anybody else reminded of Kill Bill Volume 2? Because I was.
Between Elle and Beatrix?
Yep.
Okay, so this is what I was going to allude to either earlier. Probably the hardest I've laughed during the whole movie, or even recently, was these ladies are just breaking everything. They're shattering things over each other's head. But they go through this giant plate of glass to get outside. They get up and they start fighting. And they're fighting. And right as Athena's about to be rammed through another glass door, she stops, look at Crystal, opens the door, and she goes, no more glass. And then they continue fighting inside. I thought that was probably the funniest. I mean, I laughed pretty hard. Steve, I'm sorry to hijack you. Keep going, man.
The other interesting thing about the ending was there were a couple of twists. One, which was kind of a sub-twist, a plot as to whose side one of the deplorables was really on. But the big twist was that it turns out that Crystal was not even responsible for the social post that Athena was trying to get revenge for. As I recall, it was somebody that had hijacked Crystal's identity for catfish purposes. But then, towards the end of the movie, we're given some clues that it might have been her after all that was responsible for it. So you kind of have a little bit of uncertainty there, but it's a great statement on how everybody is so quick to judgment on social media that you sometimes end up with a situation where perfectly innocent people are collateral damage in a culture war. And that was another point where the satire really landed solidly for me.
Yeah, I agree. Well, we've broken down the movie. Let's talk about likes and dislikes, hitting on the likes first. Jay, what are your thoughts on what do you like most about The Hunt?
I liked the gore. I liked that I was surprised by the story. And Betty Gilpin, I hope she's in much, much more stuff. I thought she was just an awesome, awesome character. It was nice that not only was she just an awesome heroine, but the guys in the movie would follow her and follow her lead and do what she said. And that was a really pretty refreshing way to see it. It wasn't, it didn't feel forced. It felt very natural because they'd see her do something and just be super tough and awesome about it. And they're like, I'm following her to wherever she's going. And I thought she was awesome. Like she held this movie together. I loved her. That was great.
Steve, what'd you like particularly about The Hunt?
I loved the gore. I thought this was a really great example of horror comedy. The kills just kept getting on more and more ludicrous. I was reminded at points of you know, other great horror comedies. Sam Raimi came to mind. I also liked that it had a little bit of that everything's not what it appears, because we all going into the movie knew that it was about liberals versus conservatives, but it turns out to be much more than that. And the way that unfolds, I liked quite a bit.
You know, and I have to kind of mesh both of you guys together. I was actually surprised at how almost effective this movie was written. It's a very straightforward, in-your-face movie. It doesn't try to sugarcoat anything. The story kind of speaks for itself. You know, it's a movie that does not play into anything. It just tells its story. No one is safe. And it is just going to tell you, hey, this is what's happening, and we're going to do it at a breakneck pace with some humor sprinkled in. I mean, you know, Emma Roberts, probably one of the most famous faces in this movie. I think she has like 4 or 5 lines. Her last line is, oh, that bullet almost hit me. And next thing you know, a bullet goes through her eye. I mean, it's just, it's so unpredictable and unpredictably funny is what makes this movie work.
The other thing that I wanted to mention, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but as far as one of the other things that I loved about this were a couple of references to Lost by the writers, Nick Hughes and Damon Lindelof, who worked on Lost, obviously. And then there's some elements like the unexpected explosion that you mentioned earlier seemed to me to be like a nice little Easter egg to Mr. Ertz back on Lost. So yeah, good writing, very, nice puzzle box light type of writing.
Let's dive into the making of the, well, before we do that, let's talk about dislike. Dislike, is there anything in particular that, we did not like about The Hunt? Steve, I'll let you take this one first.
Well, I kind of already tipped my hand in that the satire felt kind of uneven for me. It's almost like, the movie was trying to do too many things. I was also kind of reminded of South Park, where they were edgy, but both sides caught their vitriol on South Park. But when you don't take sides, it kind of weakens the whole impact of the satire. That said, there were a lot of levels the movie did work on. And if your biggest fault is that you're a little ambitious, that's not too bad.
Jay, what do you got for dislikes?
Yeah, I just think, and I know this is what satire is, but I think some of the caricatures of the either conservative or liberals were a little too heavy-handed at times. But it worked for me. I think it's much better than the critic score that it got on Rotten Tomatoes. And I definitely think it's worth at least one viewing. For sure.
Yeah, I mean, if I had found out that this was a Lindelof film, I never would have watched it. I have a very strong distaste in my mouth for Damien Lindelof after he destroyed the Alien universe with Prometheus. However, that being said,
That's an obscure grudge to hold, but okay.
That being said, he is almost redeeming himself. I mean, he did The Watchmen. Leftovers wasn't that bad. And this film. So I agree with what you guys are saying about the satire. It almost seemed forced at times. And you definitely, you know, when you have got, you know, right versus left, they wrote those characters to fit that mold. Why can't they just write you know, straightforward characters and let us be the judges of it. So, you know, the caricatures, I agree with you, Jay, 100%. Steve, I agree with you. The satire just almost seemed forced. Just let the story tell itself. I mean, you have such a very good story and your humor in it is going to drive the story. Just let us pick up on those similarities. You don't have to jam it down our throat. Wrapping up the hunt. Oh, you got something, Steve? Go ahead.
I was just going to apologize to Damon Lindelof for totally murdering his name earlier.
it's all good. It's all good. let's wrap up the hunt by talking about what we've been talking about. This film was directed by a trio. You talked about Lindelof and Coop. I'm going to butcher this guy's name. Coos. They had worked on Lost. But the director, Craig Zobel, all three of these guys have worked on Lindelof's The Leftovers for HBO. So these guys have worked together. Zobel, I've actually enjoyed two of his films. He did Z for Zachariah and another movie called Compliance. Both of those movies were very good thrillers. And you could definitely put The Hunt under that umbrella, but because I think there's so much gore, we're classifying it as horror. But, you know, I think that these guys work together as a team, and I can't wait for them to see what they come out. Jay, you alluded to their Rotten Tomatoes score of 54%. You know, I would love to see it get a little bit better, but I do want people to watch this movie in that aspect. But this movie was hit hard by COVID-19. But more importantly, this movie was pulled by Universal in September. This movie was supposed to be released in September, but there was two mass shootings, one in Dayton and one in El Paso. And given the context of the film, Universal decided to pull it and release it in March. And as a result, it was released in March, March 13th. And a week later, COVID-19 hits and we are asked to stay in our homes and theaters are closing. So let's break that down. Steve, what do you think about, it's almost like this movie is the little movie that could. It was, you know, it had an opportunity to be released. It got pulled. They released it, and then no one's going to see it because they can't. This movie was made for, it was made for $14 million, and that first week in box office, it made $6.5 million. So it was doing well enough. I think it would definitely make its money back, but COVID-19 really shut the doors. What do you guys think about this, the backstory behind the making of The Hunt, or trying to release The Hunt? Steve, we'll go ahead and start with you.
I think it's very much kind of a snapshot of our times currently between the political polarization and dealing with gun issues, and but also the subtext of the whole movie industry changing and studios having to do some marketing on the fly. All of that is coming into play with this movie, and it's very much a portrait of where we are 2019 and 2020. The other interesting thing is this movie, in combination with The Invisible Man, which we'll get to, the silver lining that I found in terms of the state of cinema with these two movies is that they show the incredible range in the horror genre that's going on right now. There are some people doing some really creative things that are both scary, but also subversive, but also when we talk about The Invisible Man, you got a horror that basically is elite cinema in my eyes. And it's just kind of cool how horror is one of the broadest genres we've got going at the moment.
Jay, go ahead and talk about the impact of being released at a time of COVID-19.
Yeah, well, first, if it's okay, I'd like to talk about, you know, the delay. They even made it part of their poster. They just X'd out the original date and put in the new release date, you know, with the mass shootings that led to its delay. And what I understand why they delayed it because of that, as there are people shooting people. But honestly, I'd say there are far, far more intense movies that would be related to something like that. So I understand it was a courtesy, but I think that played into some of its reputation, even though I think it would be misguided to label it as anything related to a, you know, it's good, it's decent satire, and it covers that topic. But then to be released right 7 days before the stay-at-home order in Illinois is that's rough, and it's like the movie was cursed.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't know how the purchases have been for it. I haven't looked into it or seen anything. I don't know if studios are even releasing that information.
Yeah, I don't know. I know we hear big returns for Trolls World Tour, another movie that was released strictly to digital. But again, here we are. But yeah, I mean, does anybody else have any closing thoughts about The Hunt before we move on? All right, guys, The Hunt. I'm telling you right now, it is definitely worth your time. Rent it on Vudu, Google Play, whatever you can get, wherever you can get your hands on it. It's definitely worth it. I mean, it's worth it, because even if you enjoy comedy, this movie has got it. I mean, it is very situational humor, and it is fantastic. So we're going to shift gears. We're going to go from The Hunt, an original type deal, to an adapted screenplay with an original view. I, of course, am talking about The Invisible Man. Thank God, thank the horror gods that Universal scrapped their dark universe and decided just to make individual films and gave it to the capable hands of Lee Whannell. How do you guys say his name? Whannell.
Whannell. He's Australian, so we'll give it a bit of a twang.
This guy knows how to do horror, and they put it in the most capable hands. The Invisible Man is fantastic. 90% on Rotten Tomatoes, way better than the Rotten Tomatoes score for The Hunt. This movie did super well in the box office, but then again, it was also released a little bit before the pandemic hit. But right now, this movie is the fifth highest grossing film of 2020. Very hard to believe. But it's not, given the fact that movie theaters have been closed for a month, and this movie actually did super, super well in the box office. This movie was made for a total of $7 million. And in its first 4 weeks, I think it was out for 4 weeks before the pandemic hit, it made $125 million. And there's much proof to that as we are about to dive in. We'll give you real quick the synopsis for on IMDb, The Invisible Man. It is a adaptation of H.G. Wells's The Invisible Man, but it is the story of Cecilia and her abusive ex, and her relationship with her abusive ex. When he takes his own life, he leaves her a fortune, but she suspects foul play. As a series of coincidences turn lethal, Cecilia works to prove that she is being hunted by someone no one can see. Lee Whannell is the director and writer. The only other writing credit is, of course, to H.G. Wells and his classic novel masterpiece. We are about to sing this movie's praises in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. So turn off if you haven't seen it, but this movie is fantastic. First thoughts on watching this movie. I mean, that IMDb synopsis really tells it, drives it home. Elizabeth Moss, I cannot sing her praises enough in this movie. I'm sure we all are going to. We're all going to offer insight. But she plays the character of Cecilia. She lives in a very abusive relationship. She gets out of it. 2 weeks later, she finds out that her ex has killed himself. She talks about how she took birth control to avoid getting pregnant with this guy so she can escape. Next thing you know, he's dead, leaves her $5 million. He is this big entrepreneur in optics, and he's dead. Leaves her $5 million, but then stuff starts to hit the fan. Weird occurrences, doors being open, blankets being torn off. Awesome, awesome movie. Steve, first thoughts.
Well, this is a movie that, unlike The Hunt, succeeds on a number of different levels. It's a fantastic horror movie, thriller, mystery. The filmmaking is just so damn good in this. And Elizabeth Moss, my gosh, the poor lady needs a month or two on a visa, as much as she gets terrorized in these movies and The Handmaid's Tale. She just suffers well for her art, I guess you could say. Fantastic movie, smart, good writing, good acting. I'm blown away by the fact that it only cost $7 million to make, or $7 billion. The budget on it is just, it belies a tremendous amount of quality.
Jay, thoughts?
Yeah, with the horror elements of this, phenomenally good. It was really interesting how, you know, a good chunk of the movie, it turns into a ghost movie, essentially, you know, and my last experience with an Invisible Man movie would be Kevin Bacon.
Hollow Man.
And so that was like kind of in the back of my brain when I was watching this movie. But they didn't do any of the thing where you sort of see the Invisible Man. There was nothing. You saw nothing. So he was a ghost. Quite frankly, for most of the movie, it looks like a ghost movie. And then when, with that budget that you guys had mentioned, when the special effects that do kick in, while they're minimal, they are extremely frightening and effective when they, like, really, I got goosebumps. The one scene at the mental institution, we'll get to that in a little while, but I had freaking goosebumps at that scene. It was amazing. And talking about your high praise for this, Steve, do you think you got a best adapted screenplay chance there next February?
It could possibly. I mean, we've got a lot of territory to cover between now and then. But
do we though?
Well, yeah, that's a good point. I love the fact that they were able to modernize it. The decision for explaining the invisibility has its roots in reality and totally made sense. It's a smart script. It's one of those where you can go back and revisit different points in the movie and it fills in the gaps that were there previously. Definitely rewatchable. I don't know that it's a best adapted screenplay candidate, but it definitely merits at least a little consideration for that.
Yeah, you got anything else?
Well, one thing I read that he did was the director, that he went to Elizabeth Moss a lot and said, "Hey, is this how a female would react?" He's like, "I don't know that perspective. I need you to tell me." So he really relied on the women on set and the actresses to give a female perspective to this, because this is not just a retelling of an old story. I mean, it's well based in the Me Too movement that we have going on today as well, and done very well in that regard from my perspective.
Jay, you just led into exactly my high praise. Lee Whannell knows how to write horror. He knows how to write suspense. Dead Silence. He did Saw. I mean, I could go on about this guy. There's another movie, Saw. Super low budget. Exploded at the box office. But this movie relies on his screenwriting and his way to take a scene and fill it with suspense. But this movie is driven by Elizabeth Moss' performance. She is top-notch, 100% spectacular from beginning to end. We see her story as Cecilia go from tortured soul to a woman taking her own destiny at the very end into her hands. But this movie is driven by her. I think she suffers from the curse of excellent horror performance too soon, because Jay, this movie might not get a best adapted, but it sure as hell should get best actress for Elizabeth Moss.
Absolutely. That's what I was going to say as well.
100% positive. Like, she should have it, because, and I'll go to both of you after we're done, because I mean, let's talk about her right away before we dive into the movie, because she drives this movie. Her performance as a tortured soul in an abusive relationship is, it's just captivating to watch. She escapes. You know, right when she escapes, we go 2 weeks later and we see her. She can't even go outside. It's almost like she's agoraphobic, which again plays into what we're feeling right now with COVID-19 and stay at home orders. You know, you get that, you just want to be inside. She goes outside to get the mail and someone's running at her and she freaks out. I mean, and you see it in her eyes. That's the best part about her performance, is it's her eyes. I mean, she doesn't have to do much. You can tell how she feels through her eyes, which could go back to how Lee would be like, how do you do, like, am I writing this right? You know, I mean, that collaboration really lent itself to making this movie really, really awesome. But I'm praying to God that Elizabeth Moss does not suffer the early release of a horror film too soon, like Toni Collette for Hereditary, Florence Pugh for Midsommar, and of course last year's biggest atrocity, Lupita Nyong'o for Us. Those three women should have been nominated for their performances in a horror movie, but they were completely abandoned because it was just too soon. And I'm hoping that Elizabeth Moss does not suffer that same fate. What do you guys think about Elizabeth Moss? Steve, we'll start with you.
Well, there's another connection there between Elizabeth Moss and Lupita Nyong'o. I was hoping you were going to mention that, because of course Elizabeth Moss was in Us,
yeah,
playing a completely different character than she plays here. So, I mean, you watch those two back to back and you're seeing some fiercely amazing, strong female performances between the two. So it'd make a nice double feature. And what else are you going to do during quarantine?
Yeah.
Any more praise for Elizabeth Moss?
No, she's great. I've enjoyed her since The West Wing. So I've been a fan of hers for some time. There's some things about her that they aren't part of her skill set, but what I like is she doesn't have that movie star look, and I don't mean that in an offensive way. You know, she looks like people I know, and I really I like that, and I think that makes her even more relatable. And another thing in the movie that you've talked about her acting, so I won't go into that. But the small, subtle things like the lack of makeup through a good portion of the movie, looks like she's been crying for good chunks of the movie. It seems like a lot of times when they do these abusive stories, the woman's always still, while breaking down, looks fully put together, and it lacks the realism. If you've ever met anybody that has any anxiety or depression, and she looked, not only did she act it, but she looked like, you know, you could see those emotive problems she was having on her face, and then you throw her acting on top of it, and she was great. She was phenomenal.
All right, well, let's break down the movie as a whole. I'm just gonna, you know, we're gonna spoil it right here, and then we can break down into what we like. But this movie definitely does a great job of capturing the tension, because after Cecilia gets the, you know, she gets the inheritance, $5 million, she immediately expects a hoax. Funny thing is the person that's awarding the money to her is her ex, Adrian. It's his brother, Tom. So she thinks it's this big hoax. She doesn't, you know, doesn't want it, takes it, but then she starts to get stalked. And this movie is a solid stalking movie up until a scene in a restaurant. So some of these scenes are fantastic, and it all starts with what we see in the trailer, the breath behind her. This is a point in the film that is done so well. There's no buildup in music. There's no elaborate set designs. It literally is a door opening. She goes out to investigate. She's standing there. There's no music. You're just there in that moment with her. You see her breath because it's so cold, and then you see the Invisible Man's breath. What were you guys' thought about that first stalking and then stalking from there before we get to the restaurant scene? Jay, we'll start with you.
Say my name or something.
Yeah, I didn't know who you said.
We'll go Jay.
Kind of a goosebumps a moment, because you don't necessarily expect it at that time. I had forgotten what the trailer was. Like I said, that was in the trailer, but yeah, that was really good. But one thing that did keep gnawing at the back of my brain is, if you're invisible, would you keep bumping into stuff? Because this man moves very ninja-like. Because I feel like I would bump into everything because I can't see where I am. But that's where my brain goes during these things. But that it was it ratcheted up the suspense a couple notches at that point moving forward.
Steve, what are your thoughts about these sequences?
There are so many moments. That's probably the hallmark one. With the breath, but it's as opposed to being jump scares or shocking you, the tension that is generated is amazing. And I know we talked about Lee Winnell's involvement in Saw, but you also see little elements of the real subtle, almost subliminal horror in the Conjuring series, and what's the spinoff from that?
Annabelle, the Nun.
Annabelle, yes, yeah. That atmospheric type of, did you see what you thought you saw type of thing, and I just love that type of filmmaking. Such suspense and craftsmanship.
Yeah, I'm going to dive into one of my favorite scenes, but I'll do that later on when we talk about, you know, just the movie as a whole and how it was written, directed, and favorite scenes and things like that. So let's move on.
Insidious. Insidious was the word I was trying to think of.
Okay.
Oh my gosh. Oh, I'm getting too old for this.
Okay. Okay. So, strange occurrences are happening for Cecilia. She has a falling out with her sister over an email. Cecilia did not write this. We know that she did not write this, but she ends up meeting with her sister, and her sister then is killed. And she is killed by slitting her throat, but then the knife is given to Cecilia, so it looks like Cecilia is the one who did it. Our friend Cecilia is committed, and that is where things take a huge turn. Jay, I'm going to, let's start with Steve. Steve, go ahead and take us down Cecilia's institutionalized. There we go.
We're all a little bit rough around the edges these days. her finally piecing together what is happening in the institution is another bit of great writing. And the misdirection that gets involved with Tom, the brother-in-law, but the whole thing about the dinner scene, the impact of the very visceral impact, because we've talked about how this movie isn't gory a lot, but when it is, it hits you in the face, and that murder is just a shocking moment. And I don't know about you guys, but one of the movie tropes that just totally gets under my skin, not because I don't like it, but it always makes me uncomfortable, is the falsely accused trope. And the shock of her sister being murdered immediately shuttles into the fear of, oh my gosh, I'm going to go down for this. And it's just nightmarish sequence of events for her. And again, Elizabeth Moss, by the time she gets into the asylum and is just stripped bare of all of her emotional defenses. It's just something amazing to watch.
Jay, thoughts?
Yeah, I want to riff off what Steve said, the falsely accused, and how much anxiety that brings out in him. It also brings that out in me. I'm pretty sure as soon as that happened, I was yelling at the TV, where's the security footage? Get the security footage. So I agree with that, that as an element of horror that I've never really thought of as an element of horror. But once they get to the institution, she figures out what's going on through a few other things in the movie. He's got a special suit and all that stuff. And then she realizes he's in the institution there to torture her. And she comes up with a plan to attack him back and try to make her escape and stop him. Which in the end, she ends up just damaging the suit and creating this scariest real world monster in this movie ever, because his suit just glitches and sometimes you see him in the suit and then he's invisible, and it's one of the most frightening chase sequences I think I've ever seen. I think it was absolutely horrifying, that whole scene where you could see him and then you couldn't and then you could see him, and man, the whole scene, I had goosebumps, man.
You guys didn't drop the bombshell though. I totally set you guys up for that.
I didn't know who was supposed to divulge it.
Well, while she is institutionalized, she discovers a little secret. She's pregnant. She's been sitting here earlier on in the film. She alludes to the fact that she was taking birth control, but we find out that Adrian was messing with her birth control. So the person in the invisible suit is Tom. Tom is the guy at the mental institution, and he says, hey, come back, we'll raise the baby together. Adrian is alive, and you can raise the baby together. That's where that mentality, Steve, that you alluded, the innocence, that's where she's, that's her moment. That is where she decides to start fighting for herself and for her baby, because she is in this abusive relationship and it's not going to stop. So she wants to prove her innocence. You know, Jay, you alluded to the suit. During the whole stalking sequence when, you know, she really wants to prove herself. So she goes to Adrian's house and she finds nothing except for the suit, because Adrian is a pioneer in optics. But again, that means nothing. So she hides it away for a later date. But I mean, there's still things where she's getting stalked before this mealtime. I mean, there's that issue with, Sydney, the daughter of the person she's staying with. And you know, it's, everything is against her, but this moment in the institute when she escapes is her character's defining moment where she decides to fight for herself. I mean, she does all this with a pen. She causes the suit to glitch when she stabs him with a pen. So let's move on. I mean, this movie is so compelling. It's so good because of the performance and the way it was written. Let's move on. You know, Tom breaks her out, or she breaks out. She gets out too, and she decides to go back to the house. She sees Sydney being attacked again. Earlier on in the film, we see a fire extinguisher. She uses that to her advantage to reveal the ghost, and she decides to, I'm sorry, I'm rattling on. She takes matters into her hand, unmasks Tom. She goes back to Adrian. This is where we get a twist. Let's talk about this twist, because when we see Adrian, he's tied up. Jay, I'll go ahead and let you drop some spoilers here.
Well, yeah, he's tied up. We find out his brother had the suit, and when she finally stops him, he never committed suicide, and she is convinced. And they never really do lay it out, but she's convinced it's still all a plot from Adrian to frame his own brother, get himself out of trouble, and have the child of his that he wants. And throughout the movie, we're told what a mastermind genius this guy is. For the love of God, he made a suit that made him invisible, so we can fully believe that this guy is a supervillain. And then by the end, the suit she had hidden away, she decides to put on. She manages to make it look like he kills himself, and she walks away the recovered, revengeful heroine that she is. Did I miss any of the spoilers?
No, you got it. So, Steve, what do you think about the end?
Jay was right in that for a while, we're not really sure how much Adrian did have to do with this. But he does make the one slip up or intentional mistake of saying surprise to her, which was one of his catchphrases from earlier. He says that as the Invisible Man, so she knows that that gives away what he's been doing. I loved how the end scene confrontation paralleled the scene with her and her sister. That was a nice little bit of bookends there. And the whole revealing of Tom and Adrian, the baby plot, really nifty storytelling that kind of lifts it above a standard action thriller. It adds that little bit of mystery in there that kind of pushes this into the next level. As a movie for me.
Yeah, you know, and Lee Whannell really likes his twist endings. But thank God, you know, thank God he didn't do it for this one. He just told a story and he told it very straight. I mean, yeah, there was a twist of Tom versus Adrian and the fact that she was pregnant, but that's just progressive storytelling, which we'll dive deep into that when we talk about the movie as a whole. But really, I enjoyed the end of the film because you know, in the classic Universal Monster shared universe, after the Invisible Man comes the next film, The Invisible Woman. And this movie does a great job of alluding to it because at the end, James, who's actually a detective, he works with her to try to set up Adrian to see that this was all fake, but all we have is his real suicide. But really, it's Celia in the suit that she stashed. So this really sets up that second film if they decide to go forward. You know, is she the Invisible Woman? Time will tell. You know, and this is where I say thank God that Universal did not pursue this dark universe with Russell Crowe being Jekyll and Hyde, the guy that is in every movie and is like the glue that sticks things together, because The Mummy, in my opinion, sucked the big one. Sorry, Tom Cruise. But thank God they decided to do straightforward storytelling with these classic movies, because when you put it in the right hands, it's going to be done well. Steve, you have something?
It's interesting to compare the situation with the Universal properties here and DC's extended universe. When DC stopped being concerned about this grand design combined universe thing, trying to be Marvel, if you will, and just started concentrating on making good individual movies, you've seen DC's fortunes kind of writing themselves a little bit, but of course, you know, all bets are off now as far as the continuation of franchises. But as you said, when you stop trying to do too much and big picture everything, and just concentrate on making a good, solid individual movie, good things happen.
All right, well, let's talk about our likes and dislikes right now before we wrap up. Steve, what is one thing that you really liked about this movie?
Again, the suspense, those little horror movie moments that just keep on ramping up the tension. It was exceptionally well-paced. The acting, as we've said, was phenomenal. Just a really satisfying movie.
Jay, what's one thing that you really, or several things that you liked about The Invisible Man?
There were several, but I got to keep going back to that chase scene in the mental institution. I think that's probably one of my favorite scenes in any movie. I thought it was so well done. It was so scary. It was downright frightening in great use of that budget and those special effects, because it looked great as well. But that scene is still stuck with me, man. I'm stuck in that scene just because it was, it, I don't know, something about it was magical and in a scary way. So that's the one I'm going to point out.
For me, one thing that I really, really liked is just the shots that Lee Winnall really utilizes. He does large tracking shots. It's not just like a close-up of something. You see a whole room. And you get that right in the beginning. The beginning is really, really suspenseful. You don't see Celeste's relationship with Adrian right away. You just see that tail end where she's getting out the door. And that sequence where she's leaving is really, really suspenseful. So that tone is really, really set by that opening shot. But one thing that I really like, just a small example, there's a scene where Celeste is making bacon. And she leaves, and the camera does nothing. It just stays on the room. And you see the bacon slowly catch fire, and you're thinking, is there somebody in this room? Now, this was before that we have established that there is an invisible man, but it's like, what is going on here? Like, and just the way that things are established and shot was really lent itself to the suspense that Steve mentioned. Really lends itself to the movie. This movie is chock full of it. I mean, Lee Winnall is one of the top horror directors, writers of our time, and I'll fight you till I'm blue in the face because this guy's a genius, but just the way that he framed his shots really lent to the tone of the film. Anybody have anything else that they want to add for likes?
Can I want to add off of something you just said with the wide shots. You know, another movie, you were naming movies, Steve, that it reminded you of. You know, I felt a lot of elements from Paranormal Activity, the first one, with those wide shots, small little things happening. That's one that popped in my head when you started naming those things.
The other thing that Paranormal Activity has in common with a lot of the other movies we've talked about, the steady shot, the long lingering shot, where you're waiting for something to happen. It's amazing how much tension just a steady camera shot, also from wide angle. It's amazing how much that can be used, and I'm seeing used more and more, and it hasn't gotten tiresome for me at all.
All right, this movie, 90% on Rotten Tomatoes, was a financial success right before. It's very hard to nitpick on things that dislike. I'll go first when it comes to dislike. There is one thing that I did not dislike, and I think it kind of lends into Jay, so Jay will talk after me. I don't know. But I think the reveal of the suit was too soon. The reveal of the suit happens when she's upstairs and she throws paint on him. I think that could have been dialed back and happened. I think it's a much bigger reveal when she stabs him with the pen and we get the glitches. I think that just adds more to the tension, and it definitely adds to that, you know, that horror aspect. You know, it's almost like Michael Myers, that presence that's there and menacing, but you can't see it. But that whole sequence in when he's breaking out and just, you know, picking off guards left and right, blipping in and out, there's something truly terrifying, and that should have been the big reveal instead of just a bucket of paint. Call me nitpicky, that's just me, because again, it's very hard to try to find a dislike for this movie because it is so well done. Jay, what do you have anything dislike?
Well, I don't know if it's a dislike. It's the thing I said earlier. It just went, and this is just thinking too much about a movie and not having that suspension of disbelief, but when you're invisible, your hand-eye coordination is going to be all out of whack. And somehow this guy is a robot killing machine. That's not really a nitpick. That's just a stupid thing that ran through my head.
I'm stupid.
I don't have any complaints. I don't have any complaints. This movie was great.
Steve, you got anything that for dislike?
I'm going to sound hypocritical here because one of the things that I just praised it for, the intricate storytelling. There are a few moments where I wouldn't call them plot holes, but the reveals are a little fuzzy, and there's not a lot of moments where plot points lock into place, and the aha moments. You're kind of still trying to figure out, well, the Tom and Adrian thing, and I like a movie that makes me think, But if it takes me out of the moment, that bugs me a little bit. But I mean, that is a quibble, because I was never jarred out of the thread of the movie by thinking too much. But it was just, I'm asking it to be 100%, and no movie's that good. But
it's only 90%, darn it.
Yeah, there you go.
Do you have an example of that, Steve, what you're talking about, like the reveals and the ahas? Are you talking about the moments when she's in the mental institution? Because, like, the whole pregnancy thing, I felt like that was just, like, forced, and they added that birth control line in right at the beginning. Is that kind of what you were alluding to?
Yeah, you get hit with a lot of elements at the same time that, and the timing of when she secured the suit away, it's... Usually in a movie like this, when you look back, there's a lot of aha, how did I not pick up on this? And that didn't quite lock into place for me as much as I would have liked.
Okay. You guys have anything else for dislike before we talk about the movie as a whole and its craft? All right, well, this movie, we're all agreed. I mean, this movie is dang near perfect. I almost said the D word. Dang near perfect, and Steve, I think in the thread you even said that this movie is almost perfect, and it really is. I mean, this movie was, I mean, we've hit it all. It was brilliantly filmed. It's got a great screenplay. It's got a great lead actress. It's very hard to kind of nitpick, but I mean, this, just those three alone really are the driving force. I mean, $7 million is what this movie was made for. And I can almost guarantee you probably $3 million of that was set aside for the CGI that takes place in the last hour of the movie. I mean, this movie does great with what it's given. What do you guys, I mean, do you guys want to share your thoughts about the production of the film? Jay, go ahead. Steve, go ahead.
It's, again, it's just amazing how tightly produced it is. It runs 2 hours, just, you know, 2 hours and change, like 2 hours and 4 minutes, and it doesn't feel like that at all. The pacing is just wonderful. Apropos of nothing, I was looking on the director's IMDb page. I don't know if you guys have heard this or not, but one of the projects that he is attached to coming up is a remake of Escape from New York. And
I think I read that.
Yeah, completely different movie vibe there, so it'll be interesting to see what he comes up with.
Yeah. Jay, any thoughts about the movie as a whole?
I was just, on top of being incredibly effective, it was a very pretty film, man. It looked sharp. It looked really nice. And totally different movie, but some of the way they move through the mansion in this movie kind of reminded me of how they move through that house in Parasite. Not to the same effect or anything, but a lot of the filming kind of in that big mansion reminded me of that. But I'm a big fan of this director. You and I have talked about the movie Upgrade and how awesome of a movie that one is. And so normally I would not be cool with somebody taking Escape from New York. I'm a big John Carpenter fan, but I don't know, man. His track record's pretty good for me so far.
Yeah, I mean, this guy, like I said, I mean, anything that – I almost want to say 85% of the stuff he touches is gold. Insidious, Saw, Dead Silence, Conjuring. I mean, this guy – is good at what he does, you know, and he's very good at almost, you know, staying true to source material. I mean, you definitely feel like you're reading H.G. Wells' novel if you've ever read it. You definitely get that vibe of, you know, I have read it. I love classic horror literature, but when you're reading it, like, is there someone over my shoulder? And you definitely feel that presence as the movie is proceeding. Last bit of thing that we want to talk about this movie, its run at the box office was tragically cut short. How do you guys feel about this movie being released digitally? How do you feel that the movie would have done had it stayed in the theaters? I mean, $7 million, 4 weeks at the box office, made $125. Jay, go ahead. Thoughts?
I think the word of mouth on this movie was was starting to take off. You know, I think this was one of those movies people saw. I'm like, yeah, that might be okay, you know. But as we started hearing more and more about it and how really awesome it was, my interest grew in it. One thing I would say, you know, with The Hunt, I would tell people, you know what, wait till that rental price is down. I wouldn't wait on this one. This is one you don't need to wait on.
It's
worth every penny. Worth every penny.
Steve.
It definitely would have made money hand over fist had it remained in the theaters. Were we in a different world where COVID hadn't happened? I would have liked to have seen this in a theater. I can only imagine how those moments, like the breath out in the cold from the Invisible Man, would have played in a theater. And I think this would have been a good movie to see with other people sharing the experience. So it's kind of sad in that way. On the other hand, it's going to receive some prominence, I think, because it was like the last successful movie before the studio machine kind of shut down its distribution. So in that respect, it may get a little bit more exposure for the quality work it is than it would have had things gone on as scheduled.
I agree with you 100%. I think this movie was just getting its feet wet, and, you know, horror is definitely making a comeback, and this movie was going to, you know, do some damage at the box office, but for the positive. Right now, it is the fifth highest ranking movie of 2020. So that speaks volumes of the fact that it was taking off in the first 3 months of the year. And it was already at number five. All right. We are going to wrap it up. This was a special full disclosure episode. We wanted to take a look at two of the movies that were released digitally. You know, there's other movies out there. Vin Diesel's Bloodshot. You've got Jim Carrey and Sonic. You've got Harley Quinn. All those movies were released digitally because of the fact that they were in the theaters when COVID hit. But we definitely recommend that you check out The Hunt and The Invisible Man. Please do, because they are both fantastic movies in and of themselves. Steve, you got anything coming up for the Front Row Network?
I'm working on figuring out what I'm going to do for a living when I grow up. So I don't have any immediate release things happening on the website, but got a couple of ideas running around my head.
Okay. Jay, you got anything coming up for the Front Row?
Whatever you got coming up. we do have a quarantine watch article. It should be up on NPR sometime soon.
Right.
Jay and I are also going to be recording tomorrow night. We're going to do a special full disclosure of the movie Lighthouse, in regards to, you know, we're all have a stay at home order. Is that a good or a bad thing? In the case of the Lighthouse, it is definitely not a good thing. Flashbacks is also going to be doing their April show. We're going to be recording for Mad Max, because why not? You see memes about what we should be wearing, and a lot of those pictures are from Mad Max. So we're going to be diving into that world, and I'll be doing that with Jay, and I may be getting a special guest. But if you have anything else, movie-wise, you can check us up at the Front Row Network on Facebook. You can also check out the Front Row Network on Twitter. We're also on NPR Illinois. If you click on the Community Voices pages, you can check out the Front Row Network on that website. But yeah, anything at all and any questions, you can just go, I forget what our email is. Steve, what's our email? You know, if
I don't know. The website is frnpod.com.
That's what I was looking for.
There we go.
So you can check us out at the front frnpod.com. But we are the Front Row Network, and we're happy that you were here with us. I am Ryan Lutens, and with me tonight has been
Jay Hoffman
and Steve Sykes.
Thank you guys for joining us, and we will see you in the Front Row.